Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 14th of May 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at RadioAlbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, Communism by the Back Door and the Freemasonic victors of World War II and Churchill's body count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good day, sir.
Good evening, sir.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Obviously, I've given notice that I'm going to retire shortly from the radio show, but I need to concentrate on my health a bit.
That's all right. That's all right. I thought we were going to leave that to the end of the show. Yeah, Dennis is retiring from the podcast after 5 years, I think. Just give me a moment, and I'll work out how many.
That'd be interesting, how many we've done.
How many episodes we've done, yeah. Just give me a few seconds here and I'll look it up. This is the 283rd episode.
Wow.
So 6 years. Because we have had some weeks when we haven't done any episodes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, about 6 years we've actually been doing the podcast for. It won't be the last one tonight. We will do another one. Next week, and we'll talk about the podcast that we've done. And if anybody's got any questions, they should put them in the chat room next week. Someone in the chat is saying, "Is he nuts?"
Yeah, could be.
Do you want to explain to them, Dennis, why you're retiring?
Well, I mean, if you compare my health to what I was 5 years ago, I'm probably not. I'm not a third of the man. So I really need to concentrate on that side to it. And it takes a lot of time up by the computer doing these shows. I'm not going to not do any more interviews. I did one on Mondays, you know, which had a great time, good fun. But it's just a question of giving a priority to my health, really.
Well, yeah, and when you've got to do something every week and you've got to prepare for it every week and, you know, you've got to be there every time and... That's difficult if you got problems with your health as well. I mean, you had, 3 months off with...
Yeah, 3 months off. And the three document or four documentaries even that I've done, you know, I can't really say much more than, you know, it is what it is and it's there to be criticised or admired.
Well, we can really say that about this series as well. I mean, we've gone into so much different stuff. I mean, we've looked at conspiracies going back thousands of years. We've looked at the war. We've looked at communism. I mean, now we're even looking at Jewish immigration and the setting up of the Jewish homeland in Palestine, the nationalist endeavor. And, you know, I never thought we would be, you know, looking at such a breadth of subjects that we have over the last 6 years, and you can't just keep going back and repeating stuff. I do think that at least we haven't repeated anything, and there's a danger of that. There's a danger of that if we were to continue doing it, I think. So it's probably just about the right time to finish doing it. And there's an archive up there with the titles of all the podcasts that we've done, and there's a write-up for each podcast so people can read up and download it and have a listen to it and find out some more about the war that they were unsure of. And of course, as you were saying, you've got your three documentaries. People can get hold of them from moneytreepublishing.com, Greatest Story Never Told, and Communism.
Yeah, there's two on sale there at the moment. That's Greatest Story. Communism by the Back Door, but hopefully not too different. This in future, we will have The Secret Masonic Victory, which, to be quite honest, was a really in-depth look at a lot of things from both documentaries, both previous documentaries.
And also we did podcasts to go along with each 15-minute episode as well. Fleshes it out more in depth. So if people are interested in finding out more about the background of the episodes, then they can check out the Truthful Out radio series. And as I mentioned, this week we're going to be looking at Jewish emigration in the Third Reich again. This will be part six in the series, and it's not actually taken from the book that we were using. This was actually sent in by a listener who said this might be an interesting subject to look at, which is basically about a bombing, and it was carried out by Jews against other Jews, and they say that this was the worst killing, the worst massacre of Jews by other Jews in history. And it was 267 people were killed, 172 were Jewish refugees from Europe. And it occurred on the 25th of November, 1940, on the shores of Palestine next to Haifa. And I'm just thinking about that. And I'm thinking, and that was the worst massacre of Jews by other Jews. 172, 267 people killed in all. How many Christians have died at the hands of other Christians in wars in Europe?
And yeah, well, they've been fooled all throughout history, I feel.
But that is something to be proud of, actually, that the most number of Jews ever killed by other Jews is 267 people. That's if it's true. And I guess we're going on the modern definition of the word Jew to today's Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews. And that is to their credit, that that is one thing they don't do, is fight amongst themselves like we do, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, well, like I said, you know, there have been times when, especially World War II, when people didn't realise the real reason behind, you know, so Christian fought Christian to save communism.
Well, I'm really discovering this as well. We're doing a series called The Greatest Britons, and we're looking at Rudyard Kipling, and we've looked at Enoch Powell, and we've looked at Baden Powell, and all of them were patriots, all of them were nationalists. But all of them were against Germany. They thought Germany was absolutely terrible. And the reason for that is because they fell for all the propaganda, all of it. The Lusitania sinking, everything. They fell for it hook, line and sinker. And that was what everybody was like back then. They trusted the government. They trusted the people in power.
I think, did you mention Rudyard Kipling?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was part of the Rothschild syndicate with Rhodes. I forgot the name of it now. They had a name for it where they were all obviously high-ranking Freemasons, and they were all under the impression of a one-world government. So,
well, this is when Rhodes was wanting a one-world government but ruled by the British, and it was more of a like Anglo-Saxon one-world government, not a communist one-world government. So there is a...
Yeah, it's somewhere along the lines, you know, that came into it, unfortunately, didn't it?
There's a nuance to it. And as we've discussed before, you've got the continental Freemasonry and you've got the English Freemasonry as well.
That's right, the French, yeah.
Two different types. Well, perhaps we can talk about that a little bit more next week. And let's get into this Patria bombing, because it's quite interesting. And it ties in with what we've been discussing before with the Jews emigrating from Germany and from the rest of Europe. Germany was occupying Europe at the time, and its policy was to encourage the reduction of Jewish numbers in Europe through emigration. Jewish organisations, both mainstream and dissident, ran operations that tried to bring Jews from Europe to Palestine in violation of the immigration rules applied by the British government. And we talked about the Havre Agreement in the earlier on in the series, and we also talked about the other agreement, which was to get Jews outside of Europe to America and other countries. And we covered the fact that Palestine was a British mandate. It was under the British government, and they were limiting the number of Jews that could actually come to Palestine. And the Germans, though, continued to export their Jews into Palestine, even though it was illegal, basically. They were helping the Jews to do what the Jews wanted to do. This required cooperation with the National Socialist authorities, who saw the opportunity to make trouble for Britain, as well as to help the nationalist-minded Jews go to their new homeland. The Central Office for Jewish Emigration, or the ZJA, worked under the supervision of Adolf Eichmann, organising Jewish emigration from the National Socialist-controlled parts of Europe. In September 1940, the ZJA chartered three ships, the SS Pacific, the SS Milos and the SS Atlantic, to take Jewish refugees from the Romanian port of Tulcea to Palestine. their passengers consisted of about 3,600 refugees from the Jewish communities of Vienna, Danzig, and Prague. And I wasn't really aware of the Jewish community in Danzig. Do you, have you heard of the Jewish community there before?
No, neither have I, to be honest. Well, not surprised, because we have Jewish communities everywhere, don't we?
Yeah, we hear about the Germans that were being persecuted in Danzig by the Poles, and I wonder what was happening with the Jews there, whether they were, I guess they were probably on the side of the Poles if they're now leaving Danzig.
Difficult to say, yeah.
The communist sympathies. Well, the story starts with Adolf Eichmann. He had been based in Vienna, and under his Office for Jewish Emigration, he had set up a system which meant that Jews could emigrate from the countries they were in to anywhere out of Europe. Eichmann enlists help from Berthold Stauffer, a Jewish businessman from Vienna, to assemble what turned out to be 3,600 Jews who wanted to leave the cities of Prague, Vienna, and Danzig. Normally, to emigrate required an entry visa for another country to be granted before you could get an exit visa, but there was a political motive. Remember, it is World War II, and Great Britain still has a colonial empire which includes Palestine. So what better idea than to send 3,600 Jews there and provoke an Arab revolt against the British Army? So exit visas were granted, and the 3,600 made their way across Europe to the Romanian port of Tulcea. And from there, the Jews embarked on the SS Pacific, the SS Milos, and the SS Atlantic, all Greek ships. And that's something that we didn't really go into earlier on in the series, I think, Dennis, about how, as well as being able to get rid of Germany and Europe's Jews, they were also causing problems for the British, because when the Jews turned up there, the Arabs went wild.
Yeah, it's like a backdoor thing, and it's just another attempt to upset everything for the British, keep them occupied.
Well, the Pacific reached Palestinian waters on the 1st of November, followed by the Milos a few days later. The Royal Navy intercepted these ships and escorted them to the port of Haifa. Warned in advance of their arrival, the British Colonial Office was determined to refuse entry to the immigrants. With the security situation in the region improving following British successes in the Western Desert campaign, the Colonial Office decided it was less risky to provoke Jewish anger than to risk an Arab revolt, and that an example needed to be made in order to dissuade other potential immigrants from making the same attempt. The British High Commissioner for Palestine, Sir Harold McMichael, issued a deportation order on the 20th of November, ordering that the refugees be taken to the British Indian Ocean territory of Mauritius and the Caribbean territory of Trinidad. So they were more worried about the Arabs causing the problems than they were the Jews. And that's quite a contrast to today, isn't it, when the Jews really aren't that bothered about the Arabs. It's just like shooting fish in a barrel to them, isn't it, with the Palestinians there?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting this week when we saw another kickoff between the Palestinians and Israel. I was really amazed to see 1,000 rockets in the sky, because I think we covered a while back where anything what was coming in, be it weapons or medics, were coming in the tunnels underground. And of course, Egypt, when the change of leadership, they flooded all the tunnels with water, which meant that there was nothing that could come in. So where they've got 1,000 rockets from is beyond me, because they really are enclosed in there.
Oh, completely. It's like a prison. I mean, it is incredible that they're able to get any defensive capabilities whatsoever.
Even breached the iron grid that Israel have as well, because they were overwhelmed. There's so many rockets that 800 got through. I mean, they're going to pay for it. There's no doubt about it. But they're probably at the moment. But I was just amazed.
There must be quite some ingenuity there in how they smuggle them through. Maybe in parts, and they smuggle parts in and then assemble them once they're in there.
Amazing.
And I think it's one Jew to every 10 Palestinians, roughly, that ends up losing their lives.
Yeah, well, that's usually the case. And the average age of the Palestinians is not really young. But the problem is they've got mixed cities as well over in Israel. So there's been some strife there with civil battles with Arabs and Israelis. So a lot of stress at the moment.
Well, that's something we haven't seen before, isn't it? The Israeli Jews and the Israeli Arabs in the mixed cities fighting amongst one another.
That's a new one as well, yeah.
Tell us, diversity is such a strength. Quite clearly, it's not a strength. It's a cause of tension. Getting back to 1940, the British had implemented the White Paper policy, that is, harsh limitations on the immigration of Jewish refugees into Palestine. So they gathered all the passengers onto one large old ship called the Patria, which means homeland in Latin, in order to deport them all to a detention camp in Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. Commanders of the Haganah wished to prevent this deportation, and they had the idea of slightly damaging the ship's side with a small bomb in order to gain some time while the ship was being repaired and use that time to cancel the trip to Mauritius. With the end of World War II and the British refusal to cancel the 1939 White Paper's restrictions on Jewish immigration, the Haganah later turned to sabotage activities against the British authorities, including bombing bridges, rail lines and ships used to deport illegal Jewish immigrants, as well as assisting in bringing Jews to Palestine in defiance of British policy. But the first bombing of a ship was much earlier, and that was of the Patria in 1940. And we talked about this Haganah group before, earlier in the series, and how they had offered to help Germany against the British. And this was the reason, because the British were limiting the number of Jews that could actually come into Palestine. So they had actually, with this white paper of 1939 that restricted Jewish immigration, the Haganah saw the British as the enemy, and they saw the Germans as helping them, because the Germans were providing all these fake visas so that the Jews could pretend that they were actually going to Romania, or they were going to Italy, or they were going to France. And in actual fact, they were headed for Palestine, but they needed these visas so they could get out of the country. And it was this Jewish office that was set up by Adolf Eichmann and various other Germans that were helping them to do this. So it none of it is black and white who these people are supporting. So you've got the Jews that are actually supporting, the Haganah are actually supporting the Germans against the British at this time. At the end of the war, they were against the British. It's just interesting to me the way that that there's a nuance to everything that you don't see when you just look at the mainstream narrative of it all.
Well, we know all about the mainstream, don't we?
Yeah. The refugees were transferred to the SS Patria for the voyage to Mauritius. The Patria was an 11,885-ton ocean liner dating from 1913 that the French company Messagerie Maritime ran between Marseille and the Levant. She had reached the port of Haifa shortly before Italy declared war on France and Britain, and then remained in the port for safety. After the French surrender to Germany, the British authorities in Haifa first detained the Patria and then seized her for use as a troop ship. As a civilian liner, she was permitted to carry 805 people, including her crew. But after being requisitioned, she was authorised to carry 1,800 troops, excluding the crew. She still only had enough lifeboats for the original 805 passengers and crew, though, so these were supplemented with life rafts. And the refugees from the Pacific and the Milos were soon transferred to the Patria, and the Atlantic arrived on the 24th of November with the transfer of 800 of its 1,645 passengers soon to begin. And this is something else we haven't really talked about, is the requisitioning of these ships. Once Germany had taken over France, we learned about how Britain bombed the French Navy. But what about other French ships that were elsewhere around the world? And what we see here happening is the British requisitioned it, basically.
Yeah, that's not really a surprise, is it?
Yeah, it should have been left neutral, though, really, shouldn't it?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Because of their attitude in bombing the French Navy, it's not a surprise that they claimed the other ships as well.
They would just take them in. And they also doubled the size of it. It was supposed to only carry 805 people, but they changed it and said now it can carry 1,800 people, which is probably pretty dangerous, you would think.
I would think so, yeah.
So they started loading it up with these refugees. While this was happening, Zionist organizations were considering how best to thwart the deportation plan. A general strike had little effect, so the Irgun tried unsuccessfully to place a bomb on the Patria to disable her. The Haganah also sought to disable the Patria, with the intention of forcing her to stay in port for repairs and thus gaining time to press the British to rescind the deportation order. The Haganah officer in charge of the operation was Yitzhak Sader, authorised by Moshe Sharet, who led the political department of the Jewish Agency in the temporary absence of David Ben-Gurion, who had left for the United States on the 22nd of September and did not return until the 13th of February, 1941. So this is interesting. So it's actually part of the Jewish Agency that was responsible for the bombing. The group that was bringing these Jews in illegally, and they were also responsible for the bombing. I mean, that's double crossing, isn't it? It's double crossing your own people, putting them at risk. On the 22nd of November, the Haganah agents smuggled a 2-kilogram bomb aboard the ship, timed to explode at 9 p.m. that day. It failed. So a second, more powerful bomb was smuggled aboard on the 24th of November and hidden right next to the ship's inner hull. However, amateurism, negligence, and perhaps even an inherent subconscious disrespect for the refugees had blinded their common sense. The Haganah commanders acted against experts' advice and placed the bomb in the rickety side of the old ship, rather than under the machine's area where there would be no passengers. At 9 a.m. on the 25th of November, it exploded. But the Haganah had miscalculated the effect of the charge, and it blew a large hole measuring 3 by 2 meters in the ship's side, sinking the vessel in just 16 minutes. The Patria disaster was the largest catastrophe ever in which Jews caused the death of other Jews. So that must have been pretty horrific. They're all on this ship, and they're not wanting to leave Palestine anyway. They're refugees, and they've got to go to this other country, and suddenly a bomb goes off, and it's their own people that set the bomb.
Yeah, but I'm not so sure if this is just the official report. I'm not sure if, you know, I mean, they're saying it was an accident in one hand, but it could quite easily be construed that, you know, to be used in propaganda for their own use if Jews were killed.
Well, this is just it, Dennis. We have to work out whether we think this is truthful or if there is more to it, because there's lots of cover-ups that we will get into. When the bomb exploded, the Patria was carrying 1,770 refugees transferred from the Pacific and the Milos, and had taken on board another 134 passengers from the Atlantic. Most were rescued by British and Arab boats that rushed to the scene. However, 267 people were declared missing, over 200 Jewish refugees, plus 50 crew and British soldiers, and another 172 were injured. Many of the dead were trapped in the Patria's hold and were unable to escape as she rolled on her side and sank. 209 bodies were eventually recovered and buried in Haifa. Trauma and despair shook the Jewish Yishuv for weeks after the disaster, as described in Professor Maya Hazan's essay, Ho, My Homeland. Each day for weeks they were collecting the dead bodies from the water, more and more as time passed. Isaac Tabenkin testified, "We wanted to curse the sea. It was as if the ship did not explode all at once, but went on exploding every day." The surviving refugees from the Patria, together with the remaining 1,560 passengers of the Atlantic, were taken to the Atlit detainee camp. Later, after an international campaign, the survivors of the Patria were given permits to stay in Palestine. However, the other Atlantic passengers were deported to Mauritius on the 9th of December. After the war, they were given the choice of where to go, and 81% chose Palestine and arrived there in August 1945. Was this deliberately done to gain sympathy for the Jews, because the survivors were all given permits to stay after all? And that's the question that we have to ask. And much of this I've taken from a Jewish historical website, and I've also taken some notes from Wikipedia, and I've also taken some notes from a newspaper report. But when you think about it, I mean, they set this bomb off, and they lost 270 of them, but 1,560 of them were taken to this camp, and the survivors were allowed to stay in Palestine. And there was such after a huge outcry of, oh, how terrible this is, these poor refugees, you have to let them stay.
Well, what makes me suspicious of it all is the fact that when they say it was an amateurish organisation, you know, to put the bomb rather than where they were told to put the bomb, where the machines were, to put the bomb where the passengers were. Amateurish is not really the right word.
Well, you would think they would know as well where the passengers were, because the person that actually put the bomb there was used to working on the docks, and that was his cover story for why he was there. It was because he worked on the docks and he worked on the boats. So there's a lot of holes in the story, and nobody really knew quite what had happened at the time when it happened. 3 weeks after the sinking of the Patria on December the 12th, as the bodies were still piling up on the shore in Haifa, the committee of MAPI gathered to discuss whether to add the Patria events to their set of Zionist constitutive myths. And MAPI was the name of the Communist Party in Palestine. And it was MAPI who actually set up the Haganah that offered to fight for the Germans. This is what I mean by like nuance to it and confused loyalties. This MAPI was the communist group. These were the equivalent of the Bolsheviks. So they're discussing how they can turn this into a heroic myth that they can add to the stories of Zionism. So, i.e., was the story ideologically suitable for the enforcement of a myth about Jewish heroism? MAPI was the Communist Party of Israel that had founded the Haganah group that actually did the bombing. And this idea of turning it into a heroic myth really does show a complete lack of morals. They decided to pretend that the refugees had all collectively committed suicide out of grief at not being allowed to stay in Palestine. And that was the story that was put out in the newspapers. That they had all decided to collectively commit suicide, and they set this bomb off because they were so upset that the British were not going to allow them to stay in Palestine. And, you know, the immediate hole that you can see in that is, well, how did all the rest of them know? It could just have been one person that set the bomb off. One person committed suicide, and he murdered hundreds of others in doing it. And it doesn't appear anybody actually asked that question. That this is the story that they put out, was that the refugees had all collectively committed suicide as a protest, a suicidal protest against the British.
And sounds like they were clutching for a story, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, it can't have been planned like that. Because it's such an unbelievable story.
Yeah.
You're saying, I mean, he must have known that there were the people above him and he was going to kill all of these people.
Well, if a bomb goes off, there's always that risk, that's what I'm saying. So the safest thing to do would be to put it with the machines where they were advised. But, like I said, the word amateurish, it doesn't even come into it, does it?
But even when he said that, he must have known, well, it's going to kill lots of people, and nobody's going to believe that they collectively committed suicide, surely. But maybe they were counting on getting support from the mainstream media in putting out that story. Because that was the story that they put out. They collectively committed suicide. MAPI completely ignored all the obvious signs of criminal negligence, of the boasting and bragging of the Haganah being involved, and of the hubris that caused the tragedy. In previous events, MAPI was an expert in the setting of committees to inquire into circumstances, but at this time, after the largest catastrophe in the history of the movement, no committee was set up and not a peep of criticism was allowed. The most fascinating aspect of the affair was the psychological defence mechanism of the leaders of MAPI after the disaster. Rather than condemning the ill practice and negligence of the Haganah and putting the perpetrator to trial, they manipulatively manoeuvred a twisted heroic narrative that removed the responsibility from their shoulders. According to their narrative, the refugees sacrificed themselves for the heroic Zionist cause. In one case, the victims were cynically compared to the fighters of Tel Hai, as if a small group of pioneers who willingly went to battle in order to defend their homes could be compared to thousands of refugees who were sacrificed unknowingly on the altar of a political party. And this is also something that they're not actually taught over there in Israel.
This is really?
Yeah, it's a secret history. They're not taught it at school. It's they do have a memorial for them.
Yeah, I've seen the graves, pictures, postcards of the graves, yeah.
But they don't tell them the truth of what actually went on. A day after the tragedy, Burl Katznelson of the ideological leadership of MAPI said to Shul Avigur, one of the heads of the Haganah, "Keep in your mind that the Patria Day is just like the Tel Hai Day for us." He further stated that the Patria was the greatest Zionist act of our time. And incredible. They're making this out to be the greatest sacrifice and the best thing that ever happened. And in actual fact, it was, well, it's just them killing other Jews. And what was it? Was it by mistake? Was it deliberate? What was the point of it? Just to get the rest of the world to feel sorry for them? Who knows?
I mean, the odds are, I feel it wasn't a mistake, but it could have been a mistake. But even so, whether it was or it wasn't, you know, you're still talking a fair amount of deaths. And then to build it up as such, as a, you know, some kind of a heroic act, crazy.
Yeah, but why would what would have been the point? What were they hoping to do, though?
Well, they always have looked for sympathy. And I suppose if they could have twisted it into such a story, then, you know, they could ride it on the back of sympathy.
I mean, why didn't they just set the bomb before the refugees had got onto the ship? Because they heard that the refugees were going to be put on there, so why didn't they?
Yeah, because they just wanted to stop the ship from sailing, didn't they? Yeah. So that's a viable point. Which leads you to the next point, is why would they do it when there's people on board? Well, there the risk really comes into it.
Katznelson wasn't the only one attempting to idealise the tragic affair either. Isaac Tabenkin said that the Patria victims were unknown hero soldiers. Pretty soon they became marchers. Bamali, the organ of the Hanoa Ha'oved movement, even placed this title on their front cover. In December 1945, The Young Worker, a MAPI party newspaper, commented, "On one bitter and impetuous day, a malicious hand sank the ship." The comment was written by the deputy editor Israel Cohen, who did not know that all of the people responsible were actually MAPI leaders. Angered by the newspaper's comments, some Haganah leaders sent Ben-Gurion's son Amos to the newspaper office, where he slapped the editor, Isaac Lofven, across the face. So half of them didn't even know that it was actually their leaders that had actually done this, that had actually killed all of these Jews. So you've got most of them there are thinking, who did this? What malicious hand was it that killed all these refugees? And yet it was the Haganah.
There's been a list of people who would have been blamed, I suppose, all enemies.
Well, yeah, the British thought it was the Irgun. Nobody really sort of knew. A bitter debate over the correctness of the operation raged in secret within the Zionist leadership. The decision had been made by an activist faction without consulting more moderate members, according to normal procedure, and this caused serious internal divisions that persisted for many years. An effort was made to enshrine the incident as an icon of Zionist determination, but this largely failed. As early as the 15th of December 1945, Isaac Lofven warned a MAPI meeting against trying to sanctify the tragedy. Some leaders of the Yeshuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, argued that the loss of life had not been in vain, as Patria's survivors had been allowed to stay in the country. Others declared that the Haganah had had no right to risk the lives of the immigrants, as they had not decided of their own free will to become participants in the underground Jewish conflict with the British authorities. The Haganah's role was not publicly revealed, and a story was put out that the deportees, out of despair, had sunk the ship themselves. This is the version recounted, for example, by Arthur Koestler. But for years, Britain believed the Irgun was probably responsible. Arthur Koestler, I think he wrote the book, was it The 13th Tribe or something, and he was writing the book saying that they were Khazars.
Right.
And he's quite a well-known author.
He's not far wrong there, is he?
Yeah, so for him to be putting that out, that these refugees... I mean, how can anyone believe that? That they all decided to just kill themselves and sink the ship when it was just one bomb that was going off. I mean, it could have just been one person that sabotaged it. I don't understand how it could have been seen as a plausible story, but it was. The Haganah's role was finally publicly disclosed in 1957. So what's that, 12 years later? When Munya Mardor, the operative who had actually planted the bomb, wrote an account of his activities in the Jewish underground. He recounted, there was never any intent to cause the ship to sink. The British would have used this against the Jewish population and shown it as an act of sabotage against the war effort. He said that it was in the highest interests of the Haganah to fight the sanctions of the British White Paper of 1939, and the primary objective was to avoid casualties. The British estimated 267 people were killed, but neither the Jewish agency nor the Haganah could establish how many had escaped the sinking and how many had died. And I'll just stop there again, but if this had been an act of sabotage against the war effort, why didn't they just blow the ship up before the refugees were on it?
Exactly, yeah.
So this is his excuse. This was, you know, this was sabotaging the British, basically. That was the highest interest, was to fight the sanctions of the British White Paper. But there were much better ways of going about doing it without killing loads of innocent refugees. Munya Mardor continued to work at the port in order to remove suspicion from himself after the tragedy. So he was working there, so he would have known what the ships were like. He would have known where the refugees were. There's no excuse for him not knowing that the refugees were going to be right by the bomb and that the bomb was in the side of the ship. Because he works there.
It just blows a hole. This story, it blows a bigger hole than the bomb did, to be honest.
The Haganah also put up an investigative body to find out why such a relatively small amount of explosives could create such a large hole in the ship. The Haganah investigators concluded that the boat's superstructure was in poor condition and therefore unable to withstand the pressure of the explosion. I just find that's typically Jewish, isn't it?
Another one, isn't it? Really?
It's the ship's fault. It's the ship's fault.
Yeah, it's like they've all got around the table and asked people to come up with ideas and just chose the one which they felt they could get away with.
It was the ship's superstructure. It was in such poor condition, it couldn't withstand the Haganah's explosive materials. So
obviously withstand the pressures of the seas.
Yeah. It was the Greek boat designer's fault. They didn't make the ship strong enough to withstand the Haganah's bomb. But just to think, you know, why would they do that? And how could they get people to believe that it was a collective suicide? Because that just doesn't seem believable to me. And yet they managed to get away with that for 15 years.
Well, that's probably because of the mainstream press is on their side, as we know. And we know that, you know, huge amounts of people can be swayed by what they read or what they see, you know, especially if they're only given one side of the story. So it's probably, they thought they could probably get away with it, and like I said, they did for a while.
Well, it also became a myth. I mean, they were singing songs about this and what great heroes these Jews were, and they loved the homeland so much they were willing to die and make this grand gesture of committing suicide because the British wouldn't let them in. And it formed like they wanted it to form a part of the founding myths of the State of Israel, because they have all
this. Well, that would cement to them what they were saying were the truth, wouldn't it? I mean, if they're building myths about it, it just cements it all.
And this
doesn't make it correct, but, you know.
Well, no, this is the thing. I mean, I guess this is the power of myth, isn't it? I mean, myth doesn't have to be
exactly
true.
Yeah.
It's important.
Combined with the power of the mainstream media.
Yeah, see, its importance is the effect that it has on you and what it inspires you to do and the understandings of the way life is. It doesn't have to be true. You know, larger than life characters and larger than life stories can be inspirational. They don't actually have to be true. So I can imagine they were talking about that. But the David Ben-Gurion, I think he was the first prime minister of Israel, and they refer to him as the great leader in the writings.
Yeah, he wrote an article in the Time magazine where it explained exactly what were going to happen and how the one world government will be formed in Israel. And that was some years ago.
Well, do you think that the Jews, when they were first setting this up, these Jews that were going over there, that they had an idea of one world government or just setting up their homeland.
I think the idea of one world government has gone back in centuries, and only started to be a real movement after the French Revolution. But certainly the idea has been there a long, long time.
Well, it's been there with certain sections of it, but I mean, the ones that were going there over to Palestine, I mean, they were learning how to be farmers and workers and tradesmen, and they learned how to do all these trades. And essentially, they were fighting against the Arabs and fighting against the British.
Well, they need to be like that to build up the actual country, because there was nothing there when they arrived. But that doesn't take away the fact that they still, I'm not saying everybody knew, but I think the leadership, people like Ben Gurion knew.
I think the Rothschilds that helped to pay for most of it, that was always their plan.
Yeah.
At the top, that they always wanted that to be there in the world court, and they wanted Jerusalem to be the centre and to have them running it.
Yeah, well, we covered that in, I think, Communism by the Back Door, where it shows the Israeli court, which is supposed to be the world court eventually, with the triangle on top, you know, the pyramid.
Square and compass.
But that's involved as well, but it's the pyramid. We have the top on off like on the dollar bill, but and also it's built in a way like the United Nations temple room, where the courtroom, you walk in from the dark into the light. It's the kind of the Luciferian doctrines.
And this Haganah group that became the Israeli Defense Force,
right?
So the people that are defending Israel now, the group that actually started that was the group that sabotaged their own people and set the bomb off.
Life throws up these strange mysteries, yeah.
Well, I think this series has thrown up quite a few strange things, like the Mossad and how that was started as a group that was working with the National Socialists to help get the Jews to Palestine, the ones that wanted to emigrate there. And then it ends up becoming intelligence services.
They work with the CIA MI5. So I think what their motto is, rule by deception, or war by deception. So they could be working for both quite easily.
You know, I'm not so sure that the actual Jews that are there in Israel, that they're really that bothered by what's going on in the rest of the world. I think they're probably, because a lot of them are right-wing minded, aren't they? The Likud party is very right-wing. And I think they have problems with the Palestinians, and they have issues with all their neighbours. I mean, you really wouldn't want to have Jews for neighbours, looking at the problems that Palestinians have and the Jordanians and the Egyptians. But I think they're probably just interested with day-to-day living and doing their Jewish things. When you see them all getting together and they're all dancing and they're all very, very patriotic and very nationalist minded. And then I think you've got another set which don't really even live in Israel, but they've got dual citizenship and they've got rich villas there, but they also live in Russia and they also live in America, and they're more involved in controlling
politics,
things. Yeah, and doing things for the benefit of Israel and doing things for the benefit of Jews and for the prestige. I think they want to have their world court there. But I think probably the actual Jews or the Israelis that live in Israel, I think they're probably more nationalist minded than internationalist minded. It's the ones that aren't in Israel that end up that we end up having tension with and conflicts with.
It's true. I once saw a YouTube video once of a guy going around asking members of Jews in Israel what they thought about the prophecy of them all having 200 slaves, which is in the Bible somewhere apparently. And some believed it, some didn't. You know, that's what they say, that once everyone is under this one world government, then they have so many slaves.
Well, they have some pretty crazy ideas, and most of it comes from the Talmud and then Talmudic interpretation of something that's in the Bible, rather than it coming straight from the Bible. It's usually a Talmudic interpretation of it. But
yeah.
I think when they're in Israel, they may be causing problems for their neighbours, but I think they're nationalist minded. If you look at the videos, I saw a video this week And there was just thousands of them, all these Orthodox Jews, like dancing and waving the Israeli flags. And, you know, it's just pure nationalism. They're just like happy to be Jews and dancing about and, you know, just getting off on the fact that they're all Jews together in their ethnic nation. And that's not causing a problem as far as I can see. It's when we have others within our nation that are seeking to weaken our nation to benefit them because they're living in our nation, because we're in a multicultural country, if you see what I mean. Israel's not a multicultural.
I do take what you're saying. It's a weird one because of the situation of the Jews where they never had the homeland. So there was, you know, always a separate contingent in every single country in the world. And this separate contingent was obviously the Jew. And but they never really thought themselves as part of that country.
Well, they've worked hard to keep themselves separate from it, haven't they? And to separate themselves, and they wanted to live in their ghettos, and their books tell them they should be living apart, and they should only be marrying other Jews, and look down on the nations that they're living among, and think of themselves as better. And that way, they managed to preserve themselves instead of becoming blended in with the nations that
were around. Which you think would have happened once they got cast out around the world? You just think they would have. For some reason, they have managed to stay separate. Not every Jew, but the majority of them, I think.
Well, I think that there's also an element of hypocrisy in, you know, criticising what's going on with Palestine. When you look at every country in the world is soaked in the blood of its ancestors, and there is always somebody else that's living there first. And you think we went to America, and, you know, I don't know how many Red Indians actually died in the Red Indian Wars. And you've got America now, and they've got reservations that the Red Indians live on. And I'm sure the Israelis look at that and they say, well, we're quite happy to give the Palestinians a few reservations. Why are you criticising us for what we're doing? We're just, this is our country now. And that's the way it is. And it's just, we're not used to seeing it. But it's I can't really see that it's really that different to when we colonised America.
It's an argument. I dare say there's another argument as well, but difficult because Israel, let's say, is one country which you really can't criticise. That separates them from every other country.
Well, that's another point, and that's brought about by Jews in these other countries advocating for Israel and advocating for laws where you can't criticise Israel and you can't boycott them, and that's really carried out by the Jews that are in the other countries rather than being carried out by the Israelis themselves. Why would the Israelis care what somebody in France is saying about them or what somebody in America is saying about them? I don't think they're that bothered by it. The ones that are bothered by it are the Jews that are in France, are the Jews that are in America. They're the ones that don't want Israel to be criticised.
You're quite right. Probably if they don't give a hoot of what they thought of. But in the interest of Israel being restricted, not being restricted in the plans, then certainly if you can't criticise them, goes a long way to help.
And then we've also got the crazier religious aspects of Judaism, where they think that they should have the land all the way from Egypt all the way up to Palmyra.
Well, that's a big Syrian plan, isn't it? What the Israeli flag represents from one coast to the other.
From one river to the other, from the Nile to the Euphrates.
Yeah, which at one point ISIS, who I believe were working in Israel, actually had all that territory, but I don't think that's the case at the moment.
There are pictures of ISIS with Star of David flags around their neck.
Yeah, well, they used to get any of the injured were treated by Israel in the hospitals.
And when you think the Mossad is the second biggest intelligence agency in the world, and you think Israel is just an absolutely tiny little country, and Mossad have got to be heavily in there with these groups like ISIS.
No doubt. Again, in coming by the back door, there's a section when Obama's talking, and he slips up. He actually admits to arming him. which obviously they quickly refuted.
You know, one of the strange things is that Tel Aviv is supposed to be the gay capital of the world, and you've got all this promotion of homosexuality, and yet at the same time, Israel is supposed to be a very, very right-wing country. I mean, what they're saying in the news at the moment is that they've got what they're calling far-right Israelis that are out on the streets going after the Arabs, and they're supposed to be far-right ethno-nationalist equivalent of white supremacist bogeyman that we have over here, and apparently they're in coalition with the Likud party, with Bibi Netanyahu. Yeah. He's brought them into the parliament.
Well, I mean, to me, I think people have to understand that it isn't just the Jews who are instigating a one-world government. Certainly, I class, and there's many Talmudic Jews classed under this as well, I class a lot of Satanists are involved as well, because it is a kind of a satanic culture which they want to bring. So, you know, there's a lot of, and Masonry is key to all this, of course, with the Luciferian aspect. So I think people have to bear that in mind, that otherwise there would be certain people will be getting away with murder at one point.
Would you class atheists and humanists as Satanists?
That's a difficult one. I think in the case of the atheists, for instance, we had the Bolsheviks who claimed to hate religion, but a lot believed in Lucifer. So if you believe in Lucifer, then you must believe in God. And so the two, you can't get away from either of them. Likewise, in the protocols, where they say that, you know, they have actually done that anyway, they've kind of turned everybody, especially in Britain, against God and Christianity, and yet they also believe in a God or in a Lucifer.
And when you think about it, it's to not believe in God, I mean, that's satanic, isn't it? Satan is the adversary, the opposite, the accuser. And also, if you think that if you're a humanist and you think that man creates everything and man can make his own laws and the rest of it, you're raising man up to the position of God, which is what Satan did, didn't he? He wanted to take God's place.
The same thing. They believe that man could be their own God.
So, you know, the atheists and humanists, they may not be Satanists as in worshipping Satan, but they are promoting a satanic worldview and encouraging a satanic worldview.
An antichrist view,
Antichrist, yeah. Maybe that's a better word for it. Antichrist. And then you've got the Jews that are, at the moment, I mean, I did hear something about them saying that they think their Messiah has arrived or something.
Well, that's another one, isn't it?
Anything
this
about
is,
that?
Again, how are they going to pull this one off? It will be interesting because he's supposed to be a world leader who everybody's going to admire. So obviously he has to do something which is impressive, and so impressive that the whole world will go down the road with him. But again, I think it was in Secret Masonic Victory where I covered this, where every secret society and all the Masonic lodges have all believed in this Messiah and waited for this Messiah to come. And so, you know, Skull and Bones and all the others, and even more satanic secret societies, these are the ones who are having for centuries waiting for this return. So, interesting. But whether he comes thinking that people think that he is the real Messiah, which is the idea, remains to be seen.
Well, I think it's some magic rabbi. It's a rabbi that I don't know if he's done miracles or what he's done, but apparently they've got some rabbi that they think is a Messiah. And they had one back in the 1700s, Sabbate Zvi. We did a podcast on him. It might have been when you were off ill, Dennis. We did a podcast on Sabbate Zvi, I think his name is.
Oh, right. That's when he changed to being a Muslim.
Yeah, at the end.
The thought of death. I think they had a young kid. I think I don't know whether from India or wherever, I don't know how to remember, but he kind of, it was started to be built as a Messiah, but eventually, you know, fell apart. And that's why I've been interested to see how they're going to go about it, because there must be some great illusion coming, because otherwise, how would all the world just instantly follow him? I don't know.
Well, how would the world believe that, you know, these Jews all blew themselves up on purpose?
Same thing, yeah.
You know, how would all the world believe that you could kill people with gas coming out from shower rooms?
Yeah.
You know,
and told by people who obviously have been found since then to be mass rapists in all of Europe, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so many lies that the communists told that people believed.
Like, yeah, lobbying must have been all uncovered. So what's one more?
Well, that's why it's important we have podcasts like this, which look at this. I mean, I hadn't heard of this story before. There was something else that the guy that wrote in was telling me about as well. Some anti-communist Jews that were in Israel that might have been an interesting story, but I haven't got a link to that to look into. I just had this Petria one. It's interesting that while the main story that we're told is that the Jews were in the camps and there was this plan to exterminate them, what we've actually found out is that all this work was going on to actually help the Jews get out from Europe, and it was the Germans that were doing it. It was the National Socialists that were doing it.
Yeah.
It wasn't...
Well, I've always said that it's in both interests. You know, they believe that it was in Germany's interest for the Jews to leave, and in the interest of the Zionists to go down to Palestine. So it shouldn't be a great shock to people. It's just when they suddenly claim that Hitler was really working for the Zionists, or was a Zionist, or whatever, it all falls, you know, to me, it all falls apart.
Well, that's where the origin of it is, isn't it? That's where the origin of this accusation Hitler was a Zionist. Exactly. That's where it comes from. Just because the National Socialists worked with the Zionists to achieve, because they both had the same aim. Zionists wanted the Jews to go to Palestine, and the National Socialists wanted just to have Germans in Germany.
Yes. So we're willing to help the Zionists in their agenda.
But then the story we have today is, oh no, the Germans, they just wanted to exterminate all these Jews. But what we find is that the Germans were helping the Jews. They were giving them fake visas. They were helping them to get on these ships, providing ships for them to take them to Palestine, and America wasn't doing anything to help them. America wasn't helping the Jews in America wasn't doing deals helping the Jews in Europe so that they could get out of Europe. It was the Germans and the Zionists that were doing this, and the British were saying, "Well, we're only going to allow 5,000 a year to come in."
Can I just throw this into the mix as well? There's a possibility that the arrest of Eichmann was because he knew too much. That's something that crossed my mind.
Well, I think you're probably very right there, because in the trial he said, "Look, I saved the lives of," and it was millions of Jews that he said.
Yeah.
He said, "I saved the lives of millions of Jews, and this or I helped millions of Jews get out of Europe."
Mm.
Because he set up that agency, the Jewish agency, the Jewish office that was in the SS, and that was the point of it, was to help facilitate Jews to emigrate from Europe to where they wanted to go, to this homeland that they wanted to set up, and they helped them to set it up as well with all the German machinery, all the tutoring that they gave them, the teaching them the trades, because these Jews had been used to working in the media or working in banking. They didn't know anything about, you know, getting their hands dirty. So they taught them how to farm and how to turn desert into farmland, which is apparently is what they did. Palestine was supposedly, you know, not far out of the Stone Age at the turn of the 1900s. You know, they were still in donkeys and carts. And then you've got German technology that's brought in alongside these Jews to help them build the place.
Well, sometimes everything is not what it seems, is it? You know, sometimes, you know, you can suspect certain things even because of things that you've learnt about in the past and whatever, whereas the mainstream never show this, and so people accept a lot, don't they? But it did cross my mind about Eichmann.
Yeah, it's a shame we're stopping doing the series, because I know someone who's got, I think it's an English translation of Adolf Eichmann's memoirs. It would have been good to have a look at that. But anyway, we should probably leave that here, Dennis. And you're going to do another show with us next week, aren't you?
Sure, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today.
Okay.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.